The second case for oral argument this morning is Julio Juarez Relales, appellant versus State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Jeff Larson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Megan Dilges, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Larson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Larson. I'm with the Public Defender's Office for Minnehaha County in Sioux Falls, and I'm here today to represent Julio Juarez Relales. Mr. Juarez Relales was convicted of second degree or forcible rape and sentenced to 20 years in the South Dakota State Penitentiary. That conviction was based largely upon the admission of a taped statement of my client to Detective Olson of the Sioux Falls Police Department, which statement was given without a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of my client's Miranda rights. Because of time limitations, I'll try to focus my arguments this morning on the issues involving that taped statement. For any issues that time does not allow me to address, I'll rest on the arguments in the brief. I'd like to touch briefly on the facts of the case. My client and a young lady named E.C. both attended a Mexican dance at the El Paraiso restaurant in Sioux Falls on the evening of March 8, 2008. They had previously had a relationship interrupted by my client's deportation back to his home country of Guatemala. At the dance, they spoke briefly. EC gave my client her noon phone number. After 3 a.m., and it was 3 a.m. because it was the day that the times that are the clock switch, so at time of bar closing, 2 a.m. became 3 a.m., and that's why the times on the tape are also off by an hour. After 3 a.m., there were phone calls exchanged between my client and EC. She ended up inviting him to stay at her apartment at the Hartlett House in Sioux Falls that evening. She, in fact, gave him the number for a taxi. During the time when they were together in the apartment, EC claimed she was raped by my client.
She testified to these?
Yes. She appeared to the door to talk to the officers wrapped in a blanket. She told the officers that she slept in the nude. Yet at trial, she testified she was sleeping in tank top and boxers and was forcibly disrobed during the course of the rape. The only injuries or marks on her relevant to this would be a lesion or a hickey on the side of her neck and vaginal redness, which is consistent with consensual or non-consensual sex.
Does she have any language issues?
No. She is actually born and raised in Sioux Falls, but she speaks some Spanish, and as she stated in her direct testimony, she and my client conversed sometimes in English, sometimes in Spanish.
English was her first language.
English was her primary language. At around 6:50 in the morning, Mr. Juarez Relales gave a statement to Detective Olson. It's that interrogation that gives rise to most of the issues in this case. The first issue is, should the statement have been suppressed? Both parties have agreed, both at the trial level and the briefs, that it is a custodial interrogation, so we don't need to cover that. The next issue is the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent nature of the waiver. And although I certainly understand that the burden of proof, which is a preponderance evidence of this issue, is a rather low standard, even that standard cannot be met by what happened in this particular case. The Miranda case itself says that a person's right to counsel and court-appointed counsel and against self-incrimination may be waived if the waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. This court in Cotier in 2008 pointed out that the state must not only show that the waiver is voluntary, but that the defendant was fully aware that those rights were being waived and the consequences of waiving them. That full awareness language also comes from the U.S. Supreme Court case of Moran versus Burbine, a 1986 case, where it says that the waiver must not only be the product of a deliberate choice, but must be made with a full awareness of both the nature of the right being abandoned and the consequences of a decision to abandon it. They use the totality of the circumstances analysis and basically say that an uncoerced choice and the requisite level of comprehension, only if those two things are apparent, can a court conclude they are waiver.
When you watch the tape, where in that tape would it have, would the detective been able to clue in that your client couldn't understand English? Because they had quite a bit of communication back and forth. Your client never ever said, "I don't understand what you're saying," or make any kind of indication that, "Wait a minute, I don't understand."
Sure, and I think, Your Honor, I think the trial court somewhat misunderstood the argument here. Also, the language skills is a part of the issue, but it is a small part of the issue. It's one of those factors as far as the comprehension. English was his third language. His first language is Quiche, the mountain language in Guatemala. The second language, which he learned in his 6 years of grade school, was Spanish. But he'd been in the U.S. for off and on for about 10 years and had what, frankly, I would call with clients Morel's language, an ability to carry on a conversation. But if you get into abstract principles, very difficult. I think it was very blatant immediately. The actual waiver conversation, which starts just after 5:48 on the tape, says, "Do you understand the rights I just read to you?" There's an issue there, and I ask this court to look at it. Is there a nod of affirmation? Is there a brief notice of basically saying keep talking? Or is there a silence where he's just, the court obviously is free to make its own decision of what happens there.
The tape, though, isn't very clear even to watch the tape. Was it better when you presented it to the judge?
It is what it is.
VHS it's tape, and it's kind of scratchy and jerky. And yes.
It's a tape from an interrogation room in a police department. It's the quality that we normally see, Your Honor. He then asked, "Would you be willing to waive your rights and talk to me?" And the answer is, "I don't know. I don't know why I'm here." And then the officer said, "If you want to waive your rights and talk to me, I'd be more than happy to fill you in on what's going on and get your side of the story," which basically says that if you want to waive your rights, then I'll tell you what's going on. He says, "Well, I don't know what's going on." The detective said, "So be willing to waive your rights and talk to me?" The important thing, I think, in this whole series is there's a repeated use of the word waive, W-A-I-V-E. And if you stop and think about it, even for people that have been in this country for a long time, that is not something that somebody with a sixth grade education picks up on. Detective Olson is an experienced detective. He knows at that point he should clarify. And whereas Openhousky, in the Tuttle case, when he realized that there was some ambiguity, delved in and clarified that, that was never done here. He just keeps using that. So then he goes, "I need to know if you'll waive your rights and talk to me before we go ahead." There's a brief okay, whether that's an assent or whether okay, go ahead. And he said, "Is that all right? Are you willing to talk to me?" And he goes, "I'm just here to visit my friend." That whole exchange should have tipped anybody off that there was a comprehension problem, whether it's due to educational level, whether it's due to a language barrier. None of those things were inquired upon by a very experienced detective. So I think there's three levels where there's a problem here. The question if he understands the rights, I think it's questionable that he ever indicates an affirmative on that. The waiver question was never asked, and at the suppression hearing at pages 47 and 48, the officer admits that. And "are you willing to talk to me" is not the relevant question, particularly to somebody that does not have a lot of contact with the system. The question is are you willing to waive your rights and talk to me? And it's never couched in those terms. Another thing that I think is apparent, the fact that the detective asks about the waiver 2 to 3 more times, if my client understood, why would the officer keep asking and why would the officer think he needed to? The officer in his report, which he concedes at the hearing also, stated that he didn't know if he wanted to waive his rights or not. So even the officer, at the point when he's writing the report, realizes there was confusion there. And Tuttle makes the distinction between when there's equivocation, and there's a distinction between an equivocal response to the initial advisement, which we have here, and an equivocal post-waiver invocation. And where is the initial advisement? It is the officer's duty to clarify. which I think is also consistent with this court's recent pronouncement in the Blackburn case on the ambiguous request to a lawyer, that in a pre-waiver situation where a person hasn't validly waived, it's the officer's duty to clarify. And there was no attempt to do that. We certainly have an experienced officer, and he did not go forward and make that clarification. Tuttle points out the importance of clarifying that ambiguity. Furthermore, there's an issue as to the voluntariness of the statement itself. And again, it's the state's burden to prove by a preponderance whether the statement is voluntary, and the factors are set forth in the Tuttle case. I think there's an interesting contrast here between the facts, because, first of all, Tuttle is very good because it makes a distinction between the knowing and involuntary waiver, or knowing and voluntary waiver, which in that case there was, and the voluntariness of the statement, which is a totally separate and independent determination. But in Tuttle, the failure to cooperate, the statement that if he failed to cooperate by giving a statement, it's going to be put in the report and it's going to make you look like a jerk, that is the threatening statement or the coercive statement in Tuttle that seemed to tip the court. Yet here, we even have a statement that you realize you can get a life sentence for something like this. That's why you need to tell me what happened. Almost saying it's your obligation because you're looking at a life sentence, which he was not under anything that could have been charged in this case. So what were those factors in Tuttle, and how do they apply here? First, we have age, education, and intelligence. And education, I think, is certainly an issue. At the suppression hearing, we pointed out that he had 6 years in what sounds to me like a country school environment up in the rural areas of Guatemala, and whether or not there was a rights advisement. And I think inherent in A and B of the Tuttle factors to begin with is the comprehension of the language, particularly legal-specific language. It's obvious from the tape that Julio at times can answer questions and can say where he's going in the functional street language, but there's no indication that he would have knowledge relative to the rights that are involved here, particularly growing up in a different environment. The length of detention.
Mr. Larson, that's...
Yes, sir.
Is this really a focus on the use of a foreign language or any language, or on basic understanding with the language just a factor in that?
I think it's a combination of both, but basically it's basic understanding of the factor. I think in a perfect world, Detective Olson would have got at least a Spanish interpreter in there to make sure things were clear, and I think that would have been a better practice. On the other hand, language is not the only issue. Comprehension is the issue, okay. And I think the comprehension or lack thereof is apparent from the tape, and I think from this court's pronouncement in both Acuba and Tuttle, I think this court is very free to go in and make its own determination when you have a tape involved here, and you can make your own determination as to the level of comprehension. Length of detention is another of the factors, and I think interesting here, he sits in that room for almost an hour, nodding off and on, before questioning starts at 4:52 of the tape, which I believe would be 5:52 in the morning because of the time change. So at that point, he's been up all night. The questioning itself lasts about 50 minutes, longer than some, shorter than others, I will concede. The prolonged nature of the questioning, I think particularly the degree of the questioning from 6:16 to 6:39 on the tape is of note, just because of the amount of pressure that is put on. Deprivation of food or sleep is a factor. This young man has obviously been up all night and is being questioned around breakfast hours for the rest of us. Prior experience with law enforcement or the courts. Here, I think the trial court did make an erroneous ruling, because when we're talking about law enforcement and the courts, she simply came to the conclusion that because he'd been deported before, that he had this requisite experience. We did object to those to that particular finding, and I would just point out there's nothing in the record to indicate that he ever had any court proceedings in the deportation process, and the contact with law enforcement in that type of proceeding here is much different, particularly because the same rights don't apply.
Do we have to consider that, do we have to look at whether or not this threat had an effect on him? In other words, the threat's thrown out, but maybe he blows it off. So do we have to look at that?
I think that's a consideration for the court to make. I think that it does have to be the result of a coercive action.
So was there something in the tape that we can see that where he reacts to this threat and changes his position?
He at that point starts spilling out different versions, which were obviously used over and over by the prosecution during final argument in particular. So I think it did have an effect. It's not something where he fell out of the chair the minute that statement was made, but I think what happens afterward tells the tale. And the other thing is that the big distinction there is that a deportation proceeding doesn't include many of the rights which we needed him to understand here, particularly a right against self-incrimination, right to remain silent. These things are different in a deportation proceeding. And whereas Tuttle, one of the factors was considered is the fact that, frankly, it wasn't his first rodeo. It was, frankly, his second aggravated assault charge. In here, we have somebody that's had no contact that we know of with the American criminal justice system, and the court makes some conclusion that because he's been deported that he's got all this contact with law enforcement. Finally, is the deceptiveness or misrepresentations, and again, that goes, I believe, to the comments about the potential life sentence in this particular case. I'd like to now, because of time, go to the part of the second issue relative to the admissibility of evidence to the playing of the video itself. And the reason that there was a motion in limine on that and a later objection is because during that interview, there are about 15 different occasions, which are cited at page 25 of our brief, where he's blatantly accused by the officer of lying. And State versus Raymond stands for the proposition that one witness may not testify to what another witness's credibility is.
Is he a witness simply because he's in the video?
I certainly think that it's used as a statement for the prosecution, so that he is certainly, yes, I believe he's a witness at that point.
To me, a witness is somebody who's under oath in a courtroom testifying.
He was under oath in a courtroom testifying. Obviously, it's a suppression hearing. He has a right to remain silent. But I do think that in this particular situation, he's very much a witness. Frankly, with the advent of tape-recorded statements, Your Honor, there are many times now that as a defense attorney, I maybe don't put my client on the stand because he's made a statement on tape.
I was talking about the police officer. I assume you were objecting to the police officer's suggestions your client was lying.
Well, the police officer, I think, is obviously a witness because he is actually the one that the tape is admitted through. I thought you were inferring that my client wasn't a witness because
he's a police officer. Statements on the tape, does that make him a witness? Because you kept referring to him as a witness.
He was on the stand at the time the tape was admitted. He's the person that's admitted through. And I think the Elnicki case out of Kansas comes to the rational conclusion is that there is not much difference between if you say on the stand somebody's lying and you're on the stand under oath and you say 15 times on a tape this guy's lying.
All right, Mr. Larson, didn't Judge Rypel give an instruction on the use of the officer statement?
She gave an instruction. However, I don't think that overcomes the repeated nature, particularly when the jury is suggested by the prosecutor during final argument to go back, play it, rewind it, play it again. I think that overcomes and is an attempt to overcome any limiting instruction that the court gave in that particular case.
So you would have had the judge, assuming that you didn't want it in at all, but knowing that it was going to be played, you would have preferred the judge have it redacted so that all those accusations were not there.
I think the judge had two choices. One is redaction. The other is to let the officer testify relative to any of the inconsistencies he was trying without his qualitative statement relative to whether he believed the gentleman or not.
There were quite a few accusations, I suppose, so would there be a comprehension problem for the jury if they had to listen to the tape with constant breaks and silences or whatever in it?
I think it depends on how the court handled the redaction. If the court redacted the whole part where they're the most continuous, then I think you would just have the officer say that during this time period he did this or this, or that if you did them piecemeal, you just as we do in many cases, just give an instruction that there are rules of evidence apply and there's reasons that there are places where the time is not consistent within the tape.
Would you clarify, though, I for some reason I understood there was no request for redaction in this case?
No, because we made a motion in limited to keep it out because
so,
of that.
So you never, when you lost that, you didn't say, okay, Judge, then let's at least redact.
We had made the objection when those things came in. We didn't specifically ask for redaction because I do think it was so intertwined with what it would said that it would have been difficult, and that's why we took the position at the court of that being the case. The possibility of redaction was never tossed back at us either, but no, we didn't make that suggestion.
Your time has expired, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. Ms. Dilges, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. On behalf of the state of South Dakota, I am here today to request that you affirm the defendant's conviction of rape in the second degree by force or threat in all respects. I'd like to add a few more facts than what was discussed by Mr. Larson's. The defendant and the victim first met in 2005. At that time, the defendant identified himself to the victim as Antonio. They had a relationship for 2 months. It was a sexual relationship. And the relationship ended when, unbeknownst to the victim, the defendant was deported. Sometime after his deportation, he regained entrance into the United States illegally, and they again met in 2007 at a Spanish dance. After the dance concluded, the defendant requested to stay at the victim's apartment because he had no other place to stay. She allowed him to stay there. At some point during the evening, he requested sex from her, and she declined. The defendant accepted that decline and went to bed. The next day, they watched movies, they ordered pizza, they went on their separate ways. The victim did not see Antonio again until the evening of March 8, 2008. It was at a Spanish dance again in Sioux Falls that they briefly ran into each other, and they exchanged phone numbers. The victim testified that the defendant asked for her phone number and then walked away and did a little test where he called the phone number that she had given him to make sure she had given him the correct number. The dance ended. They went their separate ways. The victim went back to her apartment, picked up her one-year-old daughter, and came home and got ready for bed. It is that time that the defendant called the victim and again asked to stay at her place. The victim did not invite the defendant over, as Mr. Larson indicated during his argument. The defendant, who she still only knew as Antonio, said, "I need a place to crash. I have no way to get back to Minnesota. Can I stay at your place?" She allowed him to come over and said he could sleep on the couch because her daughter was asleep in the pack and play at the foot of her bed in her bedroom. Shortly after the defendant went to the couch and the victim went into her room, she heard the defendant kind of walk through the hallway. She had a baby gate set up for her daughter. He crashed into that baby gate. It did not fall down. The pictures in the record show that it's still intact. But he came into the room and sat on her bed. The victim testified that he started talking about their prior relationship, but that at this point was over 3 years ago. And he again asked her for sex. She declined. She said, "I have a daughter now. I'm trying to be with the father of my daughter. You know, you can stay here, but I don't want to have sex with you."
Now, she testified to all this.
Yes, Justice Meyer Henry, she did during the trial. The defendant repeatedly asked, the victim repeatedly refused, and the defendant didn't take no for an answer. He proceeded to forcibly rape her, penetrate her, and she testified that the rape lasted approximately 5 to 10 minutes. She testified that not only was she crying and saying no during this whole time, but as was her daughter, who was at the foot of the bed when this was occurring. After the rape ended, the defendant left. He called a taxi and left, and the victim immediately called 911. When the officers arrived, they found out that he had called a taxi, and they went to the location where the taxi took the defendant. Officer Vandervelde of the Sioux Falls Police Department made contact with the defendant and asked for some identification, and the defendant gave him an ID card that said his name was Jamie Cruz Wilkins. The officer talked to him in English. The officer testified that at no time could he not understand the defendant, or did the defendant indicate that he could not understand the officer. In fact, the officer asked him, would you be willing to come down to the law enforcement training center or law enforcement center in Sioux Falls for an interview? The defendant agreed. When he arrived at the law enforcement center, he was met by an officer, Colwell, who told him that they were going to be going into an interview. There was going to be an interview, instructed him how to get there. That officer, again, testified that all the communication was in English. At no time did he not understand the defendant, or did the defendant indicate that he did not understand what the officer was saying. The defendant was left in the interview room for approximately 45 minutes, and it does appear that he did nod off for a time period in that. At approximately 6 o'clock in the morning is when Detective Olson of the Sioux Falls Police Department began the interview. At the start of the interview, the defendant has read his Miranda rights. He acknowledges those rights, and he waives those rights. They go through approximately an hour of an interview.
Well, before you go on from waive, maybe you want to address that. I mean, that's come up before. I don't know that we've ever addressed it at this level. I mean, is waive too complicated a word for somebody who is not very well educated and actually English is a second language?
Well, Justice Meyer-Henry, I think the defense has attempted to portray their client as someone who doesn't understand English and can't understand the words that are used in the Miranda warnings. But if you look at all the contact that the defendant had with law enforcement in this case and during the course of the interview, he has no difficulty understanding that. He has been in the United States, albeit illegally, but he's been here for the last 12 years. On two occasions, he's gained illegal entrance into the United States. On two occasions, he's gained false documents. He gave the law enforcement officer a false ID card. He gave the law enforcement officer a false Social Security card during the interview. There's no question that when he is asked a question in English, he responds in English.
All right, ignore the Spanish-English. Is it a question of understanding the waiver, regardless of whether or not it's a language issue or just an education? Just assume it's education or development. Is that an issue?
I don't believe that he did not understand the term waive. The fact that he only had 6 years of formal education is a factor that you consider, but you consider all the other factors when determining whether or not he understood the rights that were advised to him. And if you look at all the other factors that the prosecution outlined and we have outlined in our brief, they go to show that he does understand the terminology and the meaning of those words when they are sent to him, because unlike what the defendant claims, that he had to ask the waiver question three times because the defendant didn't understand, he had to ask the waiver question three times because the defendant tried to tell his story without answering the waiver question. He tried to say, I'm here with a friend. I don't know what's going on. Let me explain. And the detective appropriately stopped him and said, I need to know if you're willing to waive your rights and talk to me before we go further. So it's not that he didn't understand the waiver. He didn't answer the question. And the detective appropriately stopped it, didn't let him go further until he could get the answer from the defendant. And in that respect, he said, are you willing? I need to know if you'll waive your rights and talk to me, though, before we go further. The defendant stated, okay. Is that all right? You are willing to talk to me. I just came here to visit my friend. Okay. Are you willing to talk to me? Yeah. So he says, okay, and he says, yeah, meaning yes, I'm willing to waive my rights, and yes, I want to talk to you, which he'd been trying to do since the interview started. So I think when you look at the factors that this court has outlined in the past on what you consider, he was read his Miranda rights, and he acknowledged those rights. The state agrees it was not a verbal acknowledgement, but if you review the videotape, he nods his head. There was a lot of discussion at the suppression hearing on the nodding of the head and then on the okay and the yeah. The judge indicated that she had, Judge Rappel had reviewed the tape four times herself prior to the suppression hearing, and she found, as a finding of fact, that the defendant nodded his head when inquired, do you understand those rights?
So we would have to find that was clearly erroneous as far as her finding.
Yes, you give deference to the trial court's findings of fact. It's a de novo review in and of itself, but you do give deference.
But we look at the tape the same as she does. I mean,
correct.
We could look at it and come to a different conclusion, couldn't we, without having to give any deference to her?
Yeah, I mean, it's a de novo review. So, I mean, if you review the court and indicate that there was not that nod or that nod wasn't sufficient, I mean...
Is anything besides the tape that happened in the courtroom that would give that we would have to defer to because she looks at the tape and she hears the witnesses?
Correct, she did.
Or is it just purely the tape?
She heard from during the suppression hearing, she heard from... the three officers who had contact with the defendant and their explanation of the contact that they had and how they had no difficulty understanding him. I think it's that the defense is trying to claim that he didn't understand the word waive, but yet it's clear from the tape that his client understood what was going on to the point where they told him that we're going to conduct a search warrant on you when we are done with this. Didn't explain what a search warrant was, said we're going to conduct a search warrant on you where we're going to take evidence from your person. Shortly thereafter, the defendant asked to use the restroom. He was escorted to the restroom, and an officer remained in the room with him. The defendant asked the officer to leave, and the officer again said, I can't leave. I need to stay in here. The defendant attempted to wash his hands. The officer said, no, you can't wash your hands. We're going to... collect evidence when we're done here, takes him back to the interview room and leaves. Immediately upon the officer leaving the room, the defendant picks up his glass of water, pours it on his hands, rubs them off, rubs them on his clothing in an attempt to wash his hands. So he knew what was going on. He understood.
Did he testify at the suppression hearing to the effect that, did he testify, number one, and if he did he say, I didn't understand what my rights were, I didn't waive them or anything like that?
Yes, Justice Konenkamp, the defendant testified at the suppression hearing, there was an agreement that he was not waiving his rights at that time, so they could only limit the amount of questions that were asked of him. He testified, he was asked by Mr. Larson if he understood the term waive, and he said no. He also was asked, can you tell me... what the word consult means. He answered no. Can you tell me what the English phrase continuing right to mean under silent means? He answered no. That's what the defendant testified to. However, when they was on cross-examination and he was asked about the deportation process and whether or not he'd been deported, it's clear that the defendant didn't want to answer any of those questions because he was portraying himself as someone who didn't understand English. And if he would have gone in and answered the questions, well, then he understands English. So
to that extent, the court could examine the defendant's credibility
correct.
At that point and decide whether she believed whether he understood or not.
Correct. Because when you compare his testimony at the suppression hearing, which was limited in nature as to what questions were asked, to the videotape, There's a distinction on the actual actions and the communication by the defendant during the videotape. At no time does he say, I don't understand you. It's a free-flowing communication. The detective asks a question in English. The defendant responds in English. He asks another question in English. He responds in English. It goes back and forth. And if you watch the tape, you'll see that he understands what's going on. And the fact that his story changes throughout the course of the hour interview. He goes from not having sex with any woman that night and not knowing the victim to having sex with a random woman who called him on his cousin's cell phone at an address he can't recall.
He never really confessed, as we understand the word confess.
No.
But the state used those various different stories against him, which they were all exculpatory, but they turned out to be cumulatively inculpatory.
Well, the state played the video, and the state put Detective Olson on the stand to talk about the inconsistencies in his statement. At no time during that interview, the defendant never admitted to knowing the victim, never admitted that he knew her, said from the beginning he didn't know her, and until the end he did not know her. The woman that he had sex with was some unified other woman whose name and address he couldn't remember. So he never admitted to knowing the victim, let alone having sex with her that night or that morning.
And was there a defense then that it was just not, it didn't happen at all? Not necessarily that it was consensual.
During the course of the trial, it varied from he didn't have sex with her to it was consensual in nature because he admitted to having sex that night. But like I said, I don't think the defendant has ever admitted that he had sex with the victim.
And then besides the victim testifying, who else testified for the state?
They called the three law enforcement officers that had had contact with the victim or with the defendant that night and the victim, and one other officer who had only had contact with the victim, I believe. They called the emergency room treating physician, Dr. Shelley Driver, who testified as to the victim when she came into the hospital.
And then the 9/11
tape. And the 911 tape was played. Mm-hmm. They, I believe, called in the records custodian to so that they could do that. I believe that's all that testified on behalf of the state. The victim was a rather lengthy testimony, as well as Detective Olson, because those were kind of the main issues.
So I guess what I'm getting at, when the evidence all comes in, what, you know, how important was the were these statements and the videotape of the officer's testimony to the state's case?
I think they were a part of the state's case, but I would say that the main witness was the victim herself, who got on the stand and testified to their relationship and the fact that they had had a past sexual relationship. I mean, she admitted that, but she had also testified that on one previous occasion, he had come over and he'd requested sex, and she had said no. And so when he asked the second time in 2008 to crash on her couch, she didn't think there'd be any problem. He asked for sex again, and it did turn into a problem. But, I mean, the victim testified as to what occurred in this case and how the rape occurred and that she had said no and that he didn't take that for an answer. I think that she was the main witness, and then Detective Olson and the statement were also important to the state's case, but I don't think they were, you know, the only thing that led to the conviction in this case.
So mainly the state used it in argument to his credibility.
To the defendant's credibility, yes. That, I mean, he lied during the statement. I mean, he gave inconsistent answers from the get-go when the officer asked him, "What's your name and where do you live? Where were you born?" He gave a false name and a false place of birth. For the next 50 minutes, his story changed as to what happened and what occurred. I think as Mr. Larson talked about the admitting of the videotape. The trial court, I mean, the motion in limine was made 6 days prior to trial. This case had been ongoing at that point for several months. They'd had a suppression hearing on the videotape itself, and at no time was it ever talked about not that the defense had an issue with the tape until 6 days prior to trial. Prior to trial, and they did not, I believe Justice Inter, you asked, a request for a redaction. They wanted the tape out. And so the trial court, they held that conference morning of trial, I believe, is when they had the argument before a jury was selected on the tape. It was discussed that it was an interview tape, and the statements that they were requesting or were alleging were inappropriate were interview questions used by the detective.
On accusations. I mean, they were accusations. You're lying.
Yeah, they were accusations. He accused him of lying, and he was lying. I mean, so they're not accusations in the sense that they were false. They weren't made up. They were true. He was not telling the truth. But at no time did Detective Olson
We wouldn't let the prosecutor do that. No judge would let the prosecutor just point his finger at a defendant on cross-examination and say, "You're lying, you're a liar.
You're correct, Justice Conor
Camp.
And at no time,
in on the courtroom? Why would we let the...
Because that didn't happen. At no time did Detective Olson take the stand and say the defendant
lied. It didn't happen on the tape, and the tape was played to the jury. So the jury got to see the detective on the tape accusing him repeatedly of being a liar. We don't allow it for a live witness. Why would we allow it in a videotape?
Because the videotape itself is, the questions asked on the videotape were interview tactics used during the course of a 50-minute interview to gather information from the defendant. Their statements, when he said of what had occurred and said, "I didn't have sex with anyone that night."
2 minutes, go.
Thank you. That they were used to get information from the defendant.
You know, I understand it's a technique, but, you know, several courts have said that kind of video, or at least that portion of video, shouldn't be played to a jury, that it's inflammatory and tends to prejudice juries.
Yes, Justice Conor Camp.
I don't know that we've reached that. Well, why should we not you know, take some guidance from those courts?
Well, I think if you look at those cases, many of those cases found that it was harmful and it was prejudicial. There was not a limiting instruction given. In this case, there was a limiting instruction given, instruction 24, that was specific to the videotape that indicated and specifically told the jury, you heard the videotape, the statements by the law enforcement officer are not evidence, the statement by the defendant are. So they were given that instruction. They were also given instruction 26, which was the instruction that advised them they were the sole, had the sole responsibility of determining the credibility of the evidence and the witnesses that they had heard. So they were given two instructions that said, you decide. You decide what you want to listen to, and you decide, or you're told, that the statements made by the law enforcement officer are not evidence, only the statements made by the defendant. So this, what happened here is distinguishable from those other cases where the courts found there was no limiting instruction given, so the jury was never told that the statements made by the law enforcement officer accusing the defendant in those cases of lying were not evidence, that they were something they should not consider. So there, that happened in this case, which, you know, if you find that it is the same as a witness getting on the stand and testifying under oath as to the victim or as to the defendant's credibility, you have to make that determination first. Then, if it is the same, and so he was testifying to that, then there was this limiting instruction that was given that takes away any of that prejudice or that harm.
Your time has expired, Mr. Thank Lewis. You. Thank you, Mr. Larson. You have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. If the court will permit me an observation, both when I was up here and I was sitting back there during Ms. Dilger's argument, I noticed a number of times that different members of this court have made much more noticeable nods towards counsel than what my client allegedly makes at about 1 minute to 5 o'clock on the tape. And I don't think that any member of this court is intending to indicate agreement with either counsel. Any member of the court is indicating they're waiving anything or that they understand anything.
At least you hope so.
Exactly. I think you can look at that tape and make your own decisions on what my client intended to do by whatever action was there, because I think your ruling in Acuba and your statements in Tuttle make it clear that when all of the court's findings of fact on that particular part are based on the tape, that this court can review that tape and make its own decisions.
Do you have a problem with the other two officers testifying, apparently to no problems with the communication with your client prior to the interview at the station?
I don't have any problems with that, because that...
No, is that a problem for your argument?
I don't think so, because apologize for the term, but when I talk about the Morrell's English, the ability to carry on a conversation of where do you work, where are you going, where have you just been, that is a much different, and that's the kind of conversation that's held in the field with Officer Vandervelde and the other officer whose name escapes me right now. That is a much different level of conversation than you have the continuing right to remain silent, you have the right against self-incrimination, do you wish to waive those rights? That is not the nature of the conversation that was in the field, so I don't see any contradiction at all. In fact, I think it draws the distinction that I'm trying to make. He's competent to do the tell me what happened. There's an issue of whether there was any understanding on the level of the rights as far as understanding or understanding what waiving them meant.
When your client testified at the suppression hearing and the judge heard his testimony saying he didn't understand, did the judge make a credibility determination about that?
I was just scrambling and looking at my notes. I do not believe that she did. I found a generic factual finding that he understood English. I don't find anything that she ever addressed his statement that he didn't understand the term waive, didn't understand the word consult, or didn't understand the word continuing right to remain silent.
Could it be inferred that she heard him say these things? Could it be inferred from the record that she must have not believed him?
I don't think you can infer something that critical. I think she made a general finding that he understood English. And I think that the judge, and again, this is probably my failure as counsel, but I think the judge had a hard time understanding the distinction we were trying to make is there's a difference between what he's talking about there in the field of where have you been, and this legal concept that's being discussed here. And that distinction was never addressed in the findings.
Isn't it have to be inferred, though, or you win the suppression here?
Pardon?
If that's not inferred by the trial court, don't you win the suppression hearing? They haven't shown it's knowing, intelligent. And
right, but I think she came to the conclusion that because he could do the where are you going, that he understood everything in English. And I think that was the erroneous nature of the finding. I think when she heard the evidence, she said, well, I can hear him say yes and no to these questions, so I think he understands English. I think she saw it as a black and white, either you know a language or you don't. And I think that the findings came out accordingly. And I think that a view of the tape, which is, I think, is the most important thing here, shows otherwise.
Just real quickly. How devastating was that tape when he really doesn't admit to the rape?
State's final argument, pages 7 to 24. There's 17 pages of the argument. 9 pages of those are dealt with that tape. The statement is made at page 8, right at the beginning. You'll be able to watch that interview as many times as you choose. You can fast forward, you can rewind. I ask you to please look at that interview tape again. The state thought it was very important.
Did you object to the tape going back to the jury?
We did. We objected to its admission. We did the motion in limine. We did an objection at the time that it was admitted, and I could give you the citation. The objection was at third volume of the trial, page 79.
Mr. Larson, for what purpose did Judge Rypel allow the tape? If there was no confession in it, what was the purpose for the tape? Was it to impeach the witness, what was it admitted for?
Well, he does eventually admit that he had consensual sex with her on the tape.
Okay.
It gets that part in. But I don't think there's any doubt that the reason is because, frankly, my client is all over the board after the advisement and first kind of says, I don't know what you're talking about, then kind of says, well, I might know her, and then it evolves. And that's the gist of the state's argument. His final argument is he must have been lying about the consensual part because of he's being all over the board on the statement.
And I mean, that wasn't your defense?
Well, the defense was they knew each other. They had it was consensual. He'd actually, the state says it wasn't an invitation. We can quibble about the verb. He'd stayed over there just a couple of months before, stayed over the next day, bought diapers for her baby, watched movies with friends of hers. They were not unacquainted.
Did the tape come in the state's case in chief?
Yes, it came in during Officer Olson's testimony.
Real quickly, back to standard of review. You indicated you still want us to look de novo, but you know, don't we really have the tape plus the officers plus the defendant all testifying? And so it becomes kind of a combined matter. So are we back to clearly erroneous? Really?
On anything that isn't that the court doesn't draw strictly from the tape, but there are certain of the court's findings that are clearly that she's making her findings based on the tape, and it is those that I think you can make your independent decision on. Finally, I'd like to contrast the Tuttle case, because in that case, the ultimate finding of this court was that there was a knowing and intelligent waiver, but there's 3 major distinctions in Tuttle, which I think tip to show that in this case there was not. In that case, the court made a finding that there was no confusion about his rights. And I just asked the court to look at that part of the advisement and make its own conclusion about that, that he was not perplexed about the rights. And again, that's when the court said, we can look at our video ourselves and make that decision. He wasn't perplexed. Compare that to how Mr. Juarez Ralios looks during the taped interview here. And finally, prior experience even with the same charge. Those are 3 things that are drastically different between a 6-year educated immigrant who's never been in the criminal justice system here and somebody who's even been questioned about the same charge. And I didn't see the tape as your honors did, but just in reading what's printed in the decision of Mr. Tuttle is almost flippant and kind of know-it-all when he's talking to the officers during that. I don't think that's the impression that you get when you view the tape in this particular case. I think there is a strong contrast between the two.
What about the state's argument that that initial bantering, I don't know if bantering is the right word, but the initial back and forth was really an attempt to clarify?
Again,
pardon. 2 minutes.
Okay, I didn't know if it was 2 minutes or I was done. Thank you,
Your Honor. 2 minutes.
Okay.
And I'm nodding my head.
Very well. Now I've lost my
sorry.
Was he trying to clarify the waiver?
I don't think so, because he kept using the same language. I think if you notice what Open House did in Tuttle, when Tuttle was maybe playing games with him there, and say, look, what I want to know is, do you understand these rights I give you? If you want to talk to me, do you give up these rights? And he went through a more lengthy explanation. There is no breakdown of, do you understand that you would be giving up this right that I talked to you about? There is no rewording of anything. There is merely the repeating of it, and I think more importantly, that if you want to waive your rights, then I'll tell you what's going on here, which I think is probably one of the most crucial parts of this is, I'm not even going to tell you why you're here unless you tell me that you waive your rights. Now, again, all of this is wrapped in with somebody that repeatedly says that there's doubt. And the officer in his own report, as he admits at the suppression hearing, thinks that there's doubt. And in fact, at page 47 and 48, he is specifically asked, did you ever get an answer to the question whether he wished to waive his rights? The answer, no, he never answered me yes or no on that question. And so it's clear in the record that the officer knew that there was some confusion, that it wasn't just a banter, and the officer himself knew it from his own observations. So for the reasons that I've stated here and the fact that the tape was admitted with all of the accusing statements, I think leads to the conclusion that this case needs to be reversed, sent back to the trial court for a retrial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.